Well, welcome everyone to week two, session two of the Alpha Course. The topic tonight, who is Jesus? How many of you guys, this is your very first Alpha ever? You went last week, but just very first, you've never been to Alpha before. Okay, well, welcome. How many of you were not here last week that are here tonight? Okay, yeah, I know all you guys in the back. Welcome, Teen Challenge, guys. It's great to see you, as always. Well, as I told you guys last week, happy birthday, Grace. As I told you guys last week, tonight is my wife's and my 47th wedding anniversary. But what I don't understand is this. That's the gift table over here. And I don't see anything. But I know you guys want to see Annette and me 47 years ago, don't you? Don't you want to see that? I knew you did. So here we are, 47 years ago. Haven't changed a bit. Isn't that great? Well, I thought I loved her when I married her. I love her so much more than I loved her 47 years ago. And so grateful, so very grateful. But thank you guys for being here for our anniversary. Just real quick, last week we talked about the fact that most everything we do in life is faith. Everything we do in life is faith. We go to restaurants in faith. We get in a plane in faith. We have surgical procedures done in faith. Life is all about faith. You drove here tonight in faith. As a matter of fact, a dear friend of mine, I found out driving here in faith, got in a car accident, and they're not going to be here. But all of life is faith. And it's not blind faith. Typically, when we do something, we choose a career. We choose the car we're going to buy, whatever it is, what neighborhood we're going to live in. Those things are typically examined, and so from that we all build a worldview. And I want to just share this with you tonight because this is really a basic model of logic. Now, so every one of us has a worldview, and a worldview is something. It's a framework by which we attempt to make sense out of life. Okay, we want things to fit into this grid whereby life makes sense. So where we came from, why we're here, our identity, our purpose, those things are built around a worldview. And they're based upon certain presuppositions. We suppose certain things to be true. Hopefully they are. But every worldview based on presuppositions, those suppositions are held to because of faith. We believe that these suppositions are true, and so we live in a particular way. But every faith position, now think about this, every faith position is built on an authority who says so. This is basically the reason you believe. But if an authority is to be true, it has to be validated by evidence. Right? And so this is how we live. This is how we function in life. And we basically do this all the time. We get on a plane because typically an airplane will get us from one place to the other. I mean, we don't want to fly an airline that says, fly securely with our safety record of 75%. We're not getting on that plane. We don't want a surgeon to operate on us who loses half his patients or 70% or 2% of their patients. And so all of life is based upon a certain worldview, and we want evidence to support that. Whether we're going to a doctor's office or we're going to vacation in a particular place, we exercise faith all the time. So why is it that for those of you who weren't here last week, I had Liam hold up a ruler that says physical life, and then Lydia took a tape measure, and she drew it to the other end of the room, and that represented life on the other side of our last heartbeat. and I asked you the question, how many of you believe there's something on the other side of your last heartbeat, and you believe it's going to last forever, and you believe it's going to be good, and most every hand in the room went up. And so you don't have any evidence for that or to support that, but you believe that. I'm not saying it's good faith or bad faith, but this is the question I ask. Why do we spend so much time in however long we've got on this planet? And we should seriously, critically examining and studying why we live where we live, the cars that we drive, the education that we get. We spend so much time for this very brief moment that we have. But when it comes to what we believe on the other side of our last heartbeat, well, I hope so. I think so. I've gone to church. I'm trying to cover the bases. But it seems that we spent far less time seriously considering, why do I believe that there's something on the other side of my last heartbeat? Just because I believe it doesn't mean there is. And maybe if you don't believe it, it doesn't necessarily mean that it isn't, because you don't believe it. But, you know, in life, we typically, and I think the older we grow, the more we look for evidence for things. But as a kid, I don't think that's true. Now, do you remember this? Step on a crack. You know, it never worked for me. As many times, it never worked for me. I mean, these are some other things. If you urinate in a pool, there's a special dye that turns it bright red so that everyone will know. Okay, now how many of you have never urinated in a pool? I don't want anybody lying here. What about this? If you swallow watermelon seeds, an entire watermelon will grow inside you. You remember that? I mean, and then you go to the grocery store with your mom, and this is what you see. It's like, I mean, look at that family that she's holding in her hands. And then, of course, this is the one that, you know, we did this to manipulate all of our kids. Now, at the youth table, I'm not sure how they're going to do with this, but I could be blowing something badly here, but, oh yeah, right? You better watch out, right? Better not cry. So how do you break it to your kids that that there really isn't a Santa? You know, I could just imagine just sitting there with them and saying, Johnny, I need to break this to you. Santa's dead. A UFO, actually. A UFO shot Santa and the reindeer out of the sky, stole all of the gifts. And then you bring this picture. And then the funeral was so sad. The funeral was really, really sad. But you know, but we don't live that way anymore. We look for evidence. And I think that is what is so interesting about the topic of the evening. Who is Jesus? Now for those of us who grew up in mostly, I mean, I know we got folks here from St. Paul, some folks that go to St. Dominic, some folks that may go here and to some different churches, or you don't go at all. It really doesn't matter to me. But we have thoughts about God. They may be conventional or traditional. They may be biblical. They may not be biblical. They could be any numbers of things. People believe in a higher power for the most part. People believe in some type of God, some type of intellectual designer. So tonight when we talk about who is Jesus, I don't know that there is a question that needs to be, if what the Bible says about Jesus is true, there's not a question that we need to get right more importantly than that question. Now, I had personally, I'll tell you a little bit more about me next week, but I believe personally in a Jesus that did not exist. I believe there was a Jesus, but the Jesus I believed in really didn't exist. I created a fictitious character named Jesus, based on a true story, of course. But the Jesus I believed in was not to be found in the pages of this book. I didn't believe in the Jesus of the Bible or the Jesus of history. The Jesus that I had created out of my sincere, religious, stereotyping convenience. But 49 years ago, geez, when I became a Christ follower, God changed my life from the inside out. Now, I'm not telling you to believe that, but I'm just telling you what happened to me, changed my life from the inside out. But it was then that I began to look into some evidence to learn if it was reasonable to consider faith in the person and the claims of this guy called Jesus of Nazareth. What was the evidence? And so let me just take us back right now again to this worldview, all right? So the person that is a follower of Jesus Christ believes certain things, and that is that faith position is that Jesus is God. Again, I'm not asking you to believe this, okay? I'm just telling you this is what the Bible says. And that there is authority. The authority is the Bible. Now the question is, what is the evidence to support that? Is there evidence to support that? Now, if on page 12, if you want to grab your little study guides, because we'll be using those tonight to some degree, on page 12, we'll see here that he existed. Now, no critically thinking, rational, or unbiased historian believes that the Jesus of the Bible never walked the earth, or that a guy named Jesus never walked the earth. If so, then every other historical figure falls into question. How do we know that Socrates or Plato or the Caesars or any other figure of ancient history actually existed? We have to throw all those and be very skeptical of those as well. But there's not a person who believes that this man named Jesus did not exist. As a matter of fact, let me just give you an example here. There's a Roman historian by the name of Cornelius Tacitus. Now you can see the resemblance. He was Italian, like I. Tacitus was considered the greatest historian in the history of Rome. He wrote the histories of Rome, the annals of Rome. Like 30 different books make up the writings of Tacitus, and he wrote he lived afterwards, but he wrote about the times in which Jesus lived, and Jesus is mentioned in the annals of Rome, and I'm just taking a little snippet of it here. He says, consequently, to get rid of the report that Nero had Rome burned, Nero fastened guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations, called Christians by the populace. Goes on to say, Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate. So even Tacitus, who is not at all a friend of Christianity or this person named Jesus of Nazareth, admits and gives us historical evidence that this man lived and had followers, and gives us a historically correct narrative of such. But really, what about the Bible? How do we know that the New Testament? Why do we believe this thing we call the New Testament? What kind of evidence, if any, is there that we should believe this report of this man? Four Gospels that talk about the life of this man. A book called the Book of Acts, which talks about the history and how the first church, after the alleged resurrection of Jesus, began to be formed. And then the letters that were written to the churches, how we have those 27 books of the New Testament. I mean, can we possibly know what the original said? And the great news is that there is a tremendous amount of evidence. Now, I want you to, in your book, I want you to do this. So I'm going to we're going to take a little bit of time to talk about something called textual criticism. Now, textual criticism is a literary science used to determine the accuracy of particular ancient texts. This is before the printing press. This is when everything is written by hand. These are manuscripts written by hand. Now, within textual criticism, there's something, as I said, called the bibliographical test. Now, there's three elements to the bibliographical test. And if you're interested in this, you can write it down. If you're not, I'll wake you up. So one of the ways in which ancient documents are studied for their veracity, okay, is the quantity of the manuscripts. How many manuscripts do we have of this ancient author writing these particular things? So the quantity of the manuscripts. The second one is the quality of the manuscripts. It doesn't necessarily mean what kind of shape they're in. It's when you look at and you compare the different documents, the quantity of the documents you have, is each document saying pretty much or exactly the same thing as the other ones? Are they consistent? Are they contradicting one another? Right? And then thirdly, there's the time span. In other words, the time span. How much time is there between the original autograph, the writing by that author, and the first manuscripts that we see? Okay? So, quantity, how many do we have? Quality, do they compare well or contrast or criticize one another, contradict one another, rather? And then the time span, when do we see the first copy? The reason we look for where we see the first copy is it's going to tell us, was this a popular manuscript? Was it something that was respected and therefore copied over and over again? So let's just look at some of the ways in which today, things that make it into our history books, and how much supporting evidence there is or not for them. So this is Herodotus, not really him, but this is a carving of him, a sculpture of him. He was a Greek historian. He wrote of the Greco-Persian Wars. Now, he wrote between 488 and 428 BC. The earliest copy we have of Herodotus is the earliest copy is AD 900. So you see, we got about 1,300 years between when this guy wrote and the first copy that we have. And we have about 117. That's amazing that we have 117 copies existing of this manuscripts of this Greek historian. Another one is a guy named Thucydides. Peloponnesian Wars, okay, Athens and Sparta. He wrote about the same time. Earliest copy again, 900. Again, about 1350. And we have 104 copies of that. That's a lot of copies. That's pretty incredible. One more I'll just give you. There's so many of them. This is Livy the Younger. There's Livy the Older and the Younger. Roman historian, History of Rome. He wrote 59 BC to AD 17. Earliest copy, AD 400s. Time lapse, 400. We got 169 copies of those. Okay? So, I mean, we've got an amazing number of copies of things that were written a long time ago. Not exactly, they weren't laminated. I mean, these things would just turn to dust with the papyrus that they're written on. Some of us are familiar with Homer, right? Did any of us read Homer? Okay, not that Homer. This Homer. All right, but Iliad, Odyssey, but just the Iliad, which he wrote about the Trojan Wars. 800. This has been updated. The numbers in your book have not been updated. So written about 800 BC, earliest copy 400 BC. We've got a time lapse of 400 years. We've got 1,757 copies of the Iliad. I hated reading that in school. But that's what it is. Lots of copies. Well, let's take a look at something called the New Testament. It's a testimony of the life of Jesus and the history of the Christian church. Originally written between 40 and 100 AD. We have earliest manuscripts. We have partial manuscripts in the AD 130. Full manuscripts are showing up around AD 350. Time lapse 90 to about 300 years. How many manuscripts do we have? We have 23,986 manuscripts. And when you look at the quality, quantity, what was the second one? Do you remember the second one? The quality. We have a quantity. The quality, what's the accuracy? The accuracy is 99.5%. And where there's any conflict, so to speak, it's typically in grammar or punctuation. There's nothing that is contradictory in the doctrines or the teachings of Jesus or the apostles that followed after him. Pretty amazing. A British professor of New Testament criticism at University of Manchester in England, F.F. Bruce, he wrote this. He says, it was not friendly witnesses that the early preachers had to reckon with. There were others less well-disposed who were also conversant with the facts of the ministry and the death of Jesus. So get this. These books are being written at the same time as the people who were there are there. It's not written hundreds of years later. So the disciples could not afford to risk inaccuracies, not to speak willful manipulation of the facts, which would at once be exposed by those who would only be too glad to do so. On the contrary, one of the strong points in the original apostolic preaching is, catch this, the confident appeal to the knowledge of the hearers. They not only said, we are witnesses of these things, but also, as you yourselves know. So they're able to appeal to the eyewitnesses. He said, had the tendency been to depart from the facts in any material respect, the possible pressure of hostile witnesses in the audience would have served as a further corrective. See, so when we start thinking about these things, we see that the Bible, particularly as we're talking about the New Testament now, has a tremendous amount of supporting evidence. And we're just a little introduction to this information that we're talking about tonight. But on page 14, we'll see here that the Bible makes declarations about Jesus. Now, I'm not going to go into this in any depth. I would encourage you to go home, and if you don't have a Bible, we want to give you a copy of this Bible. This is the Bible that we use. This is the Old Testament and the New Testament. It's the English Standard Version. You know, some people wonder, well, what, there's the New International Version and the New American Standard Version and the King James Version and the American Version. They're all saying the same thing, just using a little bit of different language. We don't speak like they spoke in the 1600s. So reading the King James Version is a little bit difficult with all the these, the thous, the whithersoevers, and all those other words which we don't even know what they mean. And so the ESV is a really excellent translation, taking the Hebrew, taking the Aramaic, taking the Greek, and doing as best as possible a translation where we're getting as close to word for word from the original text. And again, we saw so many copies of so many manuscripts. So we see here that you'll see at the top of page 14 that Jesus had a human body. He got tired and hungry. He had human emotions, experienced anger, love, experienced sadness. He had human experiences just like we do. He was tempted. He learned. He grew. He matured. He worked. He obeyed. But here's the real question. Was he more than a man? I mean, this really is an important question. Was he more than a man? Was he more than just a great human or religious teacher? Well, what does the Bible say that Jesus had to say about himself? All right, let's look at that. And I want you to pay attention, if you will, to the numbers of times Jesus points to himself and not to his teaching necessarily. He points to himself. And I'm going to want you to write some notes along the side of your study guide. So here's what Jesus says in John's Gospel, the 6th chapter, the 35th verse. I don't know how familiar you are with the Bible. Maybe some of you are, some of you aren't. So I want to just give you in this, because Alpha is an introduction to Christianity, so it could be helpful. So John's Gospel, the as the Bible, as time went on, the Bible was not originally broken up into chapters and verses. It was just one letter. Here's the Gospel of John. Here's Paul's letter to the Ephesians. Here's the book of Isaiah, the prophet Isaiah. Well, someone came along and broke the Bible up into chapters and verses so you could find things more easily. You could reference them. So this is John, the 6th chapter, the 35th verse. Catch this. Jesus says, at least that's what John's written here, I am the bread of life. He who comes to me shall not hunger, and he who believes in me shall never thirst. Now, Jesus is not talking about here the fact that we're never going to need breakfast or lunch or dinner again. He's talking about that pang on the inside, that sense of emptiness. Like, as Pascal said, inside every man is a God-shaped hole that is filled only by the Lord Jesus Christ. So Jesus makes this comment, I am the bread of life. If you come to me, you're not going to hunger. I'm going to fill that sense of that sense of why am I here? Where did I come from? Who am I? He's making a claim that I will fill that need in you. And if you believe in me, we're going to talk about this word believe in week 4 a whole lot more than this. In me shall never thirst. So you can write there next to this, Jesus claims to fill our emptiness, the emptiness in our souls, that hunger for meaning, that hunger for having a place and being needed. He fills that. In John, the 8th chapter, this is what is written that Jesus said, I am the light of the world. He who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but shall have the light of life. Now, walking in darkness, you ever get up at night in your room and it's totally dark and you trip over something? What Jesus is saying here, life can be like you're living in a dark room and you've never been there before and you don't know where the furniture is. Life can feel that way. But what he's saying is, I am the light of the world. I will reveal to you direction in life. And I will give you purpose in life. So that's what he's claiming here. He says, I will give direction and purpose to your life. I'm light. You follow me. You'll not walk in darkness. You'll not walk in ignorance. You'll not walk unaware of the fact that there is a plan for your life. But you'll have the light of life. And you remember last week, Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Right? Then thirdly, this is in the Matthew's gospel. Jesus says, come to me. Again, he's telling people not so much to come to my teaching. He's saying, come to me, all you who are weary, heavy burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am gentle and humble of heart, and you will find rest for your souls. That sounds like a pretty good offer to me. But should I believe that? Should I believe this is who Jesus is? But again, he keeps pointing to himself. So what's he saying here? This is so important, if this is true. He says, I will give you peace. I will give you a sense of belonging. I will let you know that you are never alone. Now, if there's one thing we hear about today, you see it in the news, we hear it all over the place, is people are, seems like they're more lonely than ever. There are more means to communicate, there are more means of doing any numbers of things, but the loneliness that we experience today, suicide at rates heretofore never experienced. And Jesus is saying, I will fill that hole with my life and be to you the peace and the belonging, and I will be with you. It's quite a statement that he's making here. One more. This is John 11. Jesus says, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, shall live even if he dies, and everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Now look, I know most of us may have gone to church, may be familiar with this passage. If you've ever gone to a funeral, you've probably heard this passage. Okay, this is quite a statement. This is quite a bodacious statement, don't you think? I am the resurrection and the life. You believe in me, you're going to live even if you die. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. But then he followed that up with a question. You believe me? Do you believe this? Now that's a great question. Do you believe this? Well, who Jesus is has a lot to do with whether or not we should believe this. What's he saying here? He says, I am here for you in the dash, and I will be with you on the other side of your last heartbeat. Now, that's the claim he makes, that he's come to give us life, not just when we die, but in the midst of a world filled with challenges, midst of a world filled with heartache and trials and frustration. He says, I will be your peace in the midst of that. That's the claim that he makes. Not asking you to believe it. It's important to know that you know that. Right? So Jesus' teaching is interesting. If you look at any other religion of the world, and you look at Buddha or Krishna or Muhammad or Confucius, you can remove them from that teaching, their teaching. Hear me. You can remove them from their teaching, and their religion still is intact. But if you remove Jesus from Christianity, all of Christianity falls. Because unlike other world religions, again, this doesn't make these other religions false and Christianity true. I'm just telling you, there's a huge difference. The difference is Jesus, and I pointed your attention to so many times, he said, I am. Come to me. I will. All of the things that he talks about are based upon his claims about himself. Those are either true claims or they're false claims. But they're the claims he made. And so Jesus, you'll see following down the page a little bit, I'm not going to go into this as much as I could. I'll let you guys handle some of that at your tables tonight. But Jesus made indirect claims that we see in the New Testament of his being God incarnate. And we see direct claims as well of his claims for deity. You'll see that he claims to be able to forgive sin. Well, the Jew knew that only God can forgive sins. And they did not like, they didn't care for Jesus saying that he could forgive sin. How could he be God? He's just the son of a carpenter. All right? But here Jesus is speaking to the multitudes, and many of the multitudes there are the Jewish religious leaders. You know, they had fancy titles of Pharisees and Sadducees. If any of you have watched The Chosen, you've probably been familiar with them. But here's a comment that Jesus makes here that speaks of his deity. He says, my sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me. And now look at the claims that Jesus makes. Three big claims right here. I give them eternal life. They will never perish, and no one will snatch them out of my hand. Wow. My Father, who has given them to me, is greater than all, and no one is able to snatch them out of the Father's hand. I and the Father are one. Now catch this. The Jews picked up stones again. Now, this wasn't the first time they're making target practice out of Jesus to stone him. And Jesus answered them, I have shown you many good works from the Father. For which of them are you going to stone me? And the Jews answered him, it is not for a good work that we are going to stone you, but for blasphemy, because you, being a man, make yourself God. And this is all over the New Testament. You'll have some time at your table conversation tonight to know that. But really, was he? C.S. Lewis, whom we spoke about last week very briefly, C.S. Lewis was the professor of ancient English literature at both Oxford and Cambridge University, was a staunch atheist, and came to believe, in fact, that Jesus, as he investigated and researched, that in fact that Jesus was, he believed that Jesus was who he claimed to be. And he came up with something something called decision tree analysis. And he put this together. And if you're not familiar with this, this is really very provocative and thought. It's head scratching. It's good. So Jesus claimed to be God. Well, think about this. That's either true or false, right? He either was or he wasn't. Well, if he wasn't, he knew he wasn't, or he didn't know it, but he thought he was. With me? Okay. I know some heads are nodding, but that's because you're falling asleep, but that's okay. Now, let's say he knew it. He knew he wasn't God, but he claimed to be. He's a liar, just a liar. But more than that, he was a hypocrite because he claimed to be speaking the truth, right? Truly, truly, I say to you. So he's a hypocrite. Not only that, he's a demon because he's telling people, I'm the way for you to have life. I'm the resurrection and the life. If you believe in me, you're never going to perish. Just believe in me. Well, he's a demon because he's telling people, this is the way when it's not the way. I am the way, but he's not the way. And then lastly, he's a fool. He's a freaking fool because he dies for something knowing it's false. Well, maybe he didn't know it. Maybe he thought he was. Well, if that's the case, then he's a nutcase. He's a lunatic. He sincerely believed he was, but he really wasn't. And he needed to be in a padded cell somewhere. He was sincerely deluded. But the staunchest critics of Jesus, not friends, say that there is no way any man could stand in the face of such scrutiny all the time and be able to stand toe-to-toe with all those who would throw every shot possible against him and not blink an eye, even up to his death. Here's a comment that C.S. Lewis wrote in his great classic Mere Christianity. If you haven't read that, I would encourage you to. This is what he said. He said, a man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on a level with the man who says he's a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. I guess that would make him a deviled egg. So you must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. He goes on. You can shut him up for a fool. You could spit at him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to. Interesting. So, was he nuts? Was he just an incredible compulsive liar? Or was he who he claimed to be, Lord and God? And if it's true, that is who he is. And so, and if he is, that leaves every one of us that draws breath with a decision to make. Do I accept that he is, or do I reject that he is. Now, what evidence supports all these allegations, all these alleged claims? Well, his teachings, his miracles, his character, Old Testament prophecies, which we'll get into in week 5. These are all pieces of evidence, but Christianity rises and falls upon one bit of evidence. Did he come out of that tomb alive on that first Easter morning? If not, Christianity is a farce. It is not to be believed. It is dangerous and should be dealt away with. Now, when you look at the Apostle Paul, formerly Saul of Tarsus, who hated the church, helped the antagonists of Christianity kill, imprison, persecute. I mean, this former persecutor of the church of Jesus wrote 13 books of the New Testament. This is what he wrote in his first letter. There's so much more here, but I'm just going to give you a quick taste of this. This is the very end of his letter to the church at Corinth in Greece. This is the 15th chapter. He says this. He says, "If Christ has not been raised, our preaching is useless, and so is your faith. More than that, we are then found to be false witnesses about God." Right? Right. "For we have testified about God that he raised Christ from the dead. If Christ has not been raised from the dead, your faith is futile. You're still in your sins. If only in this life we have hope in Christ, we are to be pitied more than all men. If there is no resurrection from the dead, then not even Christ has been raised." Now, obviously, this guy knew what he was talking about. He obviously had great conviction based on what he had seen and what he himself had experienced, that something supernatural had happened. Now, you know, many have tried to explain away what is the cornerstone of Christian faith, the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Now, what most people will agree is this: the body was not there. You know, habeas corpus, present the body. And there was no body to be presented. Then where was it? Well, you know, there have been many arguments, and we're gonna give you guys, if you're here for the first time and don't have a copy of this book, this book is called More Than a Carpenter. Now, this is kind of the cliff notes of a guy by the name of Josh McDowell's book. He's written, I don't know how many, tens of thousands of pages. And please don't take one right now because you'll stop listening to me. Josh McDowell was challenged. Josh McDowell was an atheist. He was an angry atheist. And he was challenged to believe the claims of Jesus Christ. And when he began to research himself, he came to the conclusion that, in fact, this man of ancient history was who he says he was or is. So we have a copy of that book for you tonight. There's a guy by the name of Lee Strobel. Lee Strobel wrote the book The Case for Christ. He's written many other books as well. Lee Strobel was a graduate of Yale Legal Studies. He became the chief legal editor at the Chicago Tribune. His wife came to faith in Jesus Christ. He was furious. He wanted to leave her. But he said, "Wait a minute, I'm a journalist. I know how to interview. I know how to find the facts." And so Lee Strobel started actually investigating. And as much as he hated the facts that were being presented to him, when he finally came to an end of himself, he realized this is true. So in a couple of weeks, we're going to have a copy of a book for you called The Case for Christmas. One of my favorites is a book by Frank Morrison. He was a British journalist. And, I mean, look at this. Can you see this? You can't see that. I mean, he set out to write a book against Christianity. He was going to end it all in terms of Christian faith. And chapter one is entitled, The Book That Refused to Be Written. And the rest of this book is fascinating. And so, but what did people believe? They believed that some people thought, well, that what happened is people went to the wrong tomb. The women went to the wrong tomb. That's why they didn't find the body, because they went to the wrong tomb. Well, then just point them to the right tomb. The disciples stole the body. That is another argument. Well, these disciples that scattered when Judas betrayed Jesus to the Romans, they're now going to get all this strength up and this. And there was, remember, there was a Roman cohort that was put in front of the tomb to guard the tomb. They're going to just come in there. They're going to take on these Roman soldiers, beat them up, get them out of the way, then roll this stone away, and then they're going to take this dead body, and they're going to extricate it from the tomb, and then they're going to go around parading around saying, he's raised from the dead. And then they're going to die for it, knowing it's a lie. I mean, people will die for a lie believing it's true. Happens all the time. But I don't know anybody that will die for a lie knowing it's a lie. Maybe not. The Jewish officials stole the body. Well, if the Jewish officials stole the body because they were afraid the disciples were going to steal the body, then all they'd have to do is present the body when everybody starts saying he's raised from the dead. His disciples didn't even want to believe this. They were shocked as everybody else. Another is that he swooned. He really didn't die. He just fainted on the cross with holes in his body. Nobody survives Roman crucifixion. Nobody. I mean, Jesus basically had his back just torn to ribbons. I mean, the whips that they would use are knotted into the whip would be bone and other metal fragments, and they would take the whip and they would put it onto the back, and then they would just sort of whip and go like this. They would whip and rip down, and so basically Jesus' back is just tattered. I mean, blood just profusely coming out of him. He was beaten. They put the thorns, these massive thorns, into his head where blood is pouring out as well. When they crucified him, they didn't crucify through the hand, because if you crucify through the hand, the nail will just come right out past the fingers. They crucified in this joint here where there's an ulnar nerve, and when you pierce that area, the ulnar nerve just goes, and you're just completely out of control muscularly. Nobody survived crucifixion. As a matter of fact, it's interesting. Many years ago, the American Medical Association published a journal on the physical death of Jesus Christ, and we've actually got a copy of this for you as well. If you'd like to get a digital copy, you can just email me, or just ask me some other time, and I'll get that to you. But this goes through the actual physical death of a person crucified. It is horrific, but nobody survives crucifixion. I mean, could you imagine if he did undrape himself from the grave cloths and then showed up to his disciples with holes in his feet, holes in his hands, and tattered and he presents himself as God overcoming the grave? I don't think so. He'd have been a mess. So many have wrestled with the question, who is Jesus Christ? Maybe some of us haven't wrestled with it. We just kind of accepted it. As I grew up in a country where you go to church and Jesus is Jesus and Jesus is just all right with me. Oh, yeah. But this question has echoed through the canyons of time, and it lands into each of our hearing this evening. The question of the resurrection of Jesus and who he is the question that I would humbly argue he is asking to each and every one of us tonight, every one of you watching live stream tonight. He's asking this question, who do you say that I am? As a matter of fact, Jesus asked that question to his disciples in Matthew and in Matthew's gospel. He says, when Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, who do people say the Son of Man is? And they replied, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others, Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. Well, then Jesus turned to them and said, but what about you? Who do you say that I am? What if Jesus asked you that question tonight? Just looked you square in the eye, and he said, I'm not asking you who you Sunday box check say that I am. I'm not asking you who you giving lip service say that I am. I'm saying, who do you full-throated, faith-filled with conviction say, believe, and live that I am? That's a good question. And if this Jesus is what this Bible says, who it says he is, if this Jesus is raised from the dead and is alive and actually is the resurrection and the life, and those who believe in him will never die, even when we put off this earth suit, what do we have to say about who he is? Just ask this question to you. What if who I say Jesus is determines who Jesus says I am? Now think about that. What if who I say Jesus is determines who Jesus says that I am? Do I truly believe that he is who he says he is? And does my life show it? Or am I just, that's what I was. I was a box checker. That's what I did. I'd show up on Sunday. If I needed something, I'd make sure to go to church. So, hey, God, I'm here. So next week I'll talk to you more about the deals I used to make with God. But what are the question? What are the ramifications for you and me if Jesus Christ did not stay in that tomb and was in fact resurrected? What are the dash in this physical life ramifications? And what are the ramifications on the other side of my heartbeat forever if Jesus, in fact, did not stay put in that tomb? What does the person of Jesus Christ really have to do with me and the way I live my life? If he is who he says he is, everything. Have I possibly, think about this, have you possibly not critically examined who Jesus is closely enough, or maybe not at all? Now, we're going to address this next week, and I hope, will you just come back one more week? Just come back. You don't have to come back. No, I want you to come back the next week too. But I really want you to come back next week, because next week we're going to talk about something I had no clue to. Going to church my whole life, no idea. Why did Jesus die? I had maybe a general idea, but a biblical idea, I had no clue. I was surprised by the answer, and maybe you will be too. So, hey, it's not too late to invite friends if you want to invite somebody else to come. These first two sessions, people have said are pretty much a warm-up for weeks 3 and 4. And so, so next week we hope to see you for that. Now, look, we're going to take a break real quick. There's coffee. There's probably ice cream. And so, anyway, then get back to your tables as quickly as you can. We're going to start flashing the lights at about 20 till 9. Thank you guys so much for being here. We really appreciate it very much. We hope to see you next week.